Tonight I thought I'd offer what I think of as a Dharma collage, just a basic theme in variations, with some ideas that I've been thinking about related to the Dharma in practice, and then we can open it up for questions and discussion. When I think of what the heart of our Dharma practice is about, you know, just the heart of the Buddhist teachings, it's something that is repeated very often in the discourses in the suttas, and for me it just captures the essence, you know, of what it is that we're doing here. There's a phrase which is often repeated, liberation through non-clinging. And he said, this is the deathless, namely liberation through non-clinging. He said that the Tathagata, which is how he referred to himself, has discovered sublime peace, namely liberation through non-clinging. So that is just such a simple way of understanding what it is that we're actually practicing. You know, with whatever method we're using, whatever tradition we're in, it always comes down to that. That's where freedom of mind is to be found, in the mind of non-clinging. So the question then for us, and particularly for us as lay people, you know, living quite active, engaged lives in the world, how can we understand this liberation of non-clinging in our ordinary daily lives? And how can we practice it? How can we apply it? And we can look at it from so many different angles. Just as a couple of examples. This one is something that's extremely ordinary, but just stuck in my mind for many years. It was an experience I had quite a few years ago. I was walking down the streets of New York, and I was on, I don't know, some from Madison Avenue or Fifth Avenue, and there were just a lot of, you know, fantastic stores and shops with great things in them. And as I was walking down the street, I was watching myself just, oh, that would be nice. You know, there really some beautiful things. You know, and there's so store after store, oh, yeah, that would be great. And so I spent, I don't know, half an hour or however long I was walking up the street in that mind state. And it felt like fun. You know, I was enjoying myself. It just so happened that a few weeks later, I happened to be in New York again on the same street. And for some reason, my mind was in a different space. It was in a non-wanting space. And I was walking down the street, same stores, same stuff in the windows, and there was just no wanting of anything. And I remembered having been there a few weeks before and the difference of that mind state where I was, you know, looking and wanting and desiring, not in a particularly unpleasant way, but the difference between the two states of the mind reaching out and wanting or clinging or grasping and not wanting, not clinging, was so striking to me. The difference was so noticeable. That second time, as I was walking down the street, my mind felt completely open and at ease, and I was seeing everything. It wasn't that I was keeping things out. I was noticing everything that was there, but there was this tremendous ease in the mind. And so it was just another example, you know, for us to pay attention to how our minds are relating to the range of experience that we have all day long. Not clinging doesn't mean shutting off our senses or shutting off our relationship to the world. You know, all day long, we're filled with experiences. But how is our mind in relationship to all that? You know, is it grasping? Is it wanting or not? And this is not something to just believe. In fact, don't believe anything I say. Please don't. everything is simply a suggestion for your own investigation. Because that's the only meaningful way the transformation takes place. It's not a question of believing anything. Make the experiment and just watch your own mind, you know, in those times of wanting, in those times of not wanting, and see the difference for yourself. For me, it was really noticeable. Another place where we can learn a tremendous amount about not clinging, and maybe it's the most important area for us just in our daily lives, is our relationship to the many, many, many thoughts that arise in the mind. How many thoughts do you think you have in a day? I think I read in some science article, I said somehow they measured it. Unfortunately, I can't remember the number, but it was no less than 10,000. You know, and it might have been many more than that, but it was some really big number of thoughts. How many of those do we actually notice? Probably not that many. And yet all of these thoughts are driving our lives. You know, our thoughts are just directing us. Go here, go there, do this, do that. You know, feel this way, feel that way. You know, these thoughts are like, they're like little dictators of the mind. And so a very interesting question to ask, and one which is very rarely asked, you know, in the course of a lifetime of millions and millions of thoughts, do we ever stop and ask, what is a thought? Not what is the thought is saying, which is what we usually engage with, but rather, what is it as a phenomenon? This phenomenon that happens so often, excuse me, and has so much control over our lives, and yet it's very rare that people will stop and look directly enough, be mindful enough of a thought as it's happening to ask that question, well, what is this? And what's so striking, what's so unbelievably liberating, is to see that when thoughts are unnoticed, they have tremendous power in our lives. They enslave us. And when they are noticed, we see that they're hardly anything at all. You know, when we're really looking at a thought and we're asking the question, what is a thought? It's like this little energy blip that happens in a moment and is gone in a moment. And the dissonance between the power they have when they're not noticed and the freedom that we have when they are noticed is so huge. So I would suggest, as part of your daily practice, just as we go through the day, can we learn, can we practice paying greater attention to the thoughts that are coming through the mind and not being so caught up in the story of them, but really understanding their empty nature? Because once we understand their essential emptiness, then there's this tremendous ease and freedom. The thoughts will still come, and the content of them will be conditioned by many things, be conditioned by our background, our childhood, and our education, and, you know, the stories of our lives. But the content becomes much less important when we understand their empty nature. You know, that as a phenomenon, they're very insubstantial. And when we see that, and then can be aware of whatever the thought may be as it's coming, arising the day, then there's great space and ease of choosing, of discerning, oh, is this thought helpful? I'll act on it. Is this thought not helpful? I can just let it go. And we're not ascribing to it, we're not handing over power to it. So this is a tremendous practice that all of us can do and need to do if we want to experience greater freedom in our lives. I had an interesting experience on my last retreat. I was doing a self-retreat at home in Barre, Massachusetts. It was in the winter. And I would be doing walking meditation sometimes outside. It was very cold, really cold, like 0 degrees, 10 below, and an icy wind. And part of me loves it. It's not pleasant, but it's so intense. You know, it's impossible not to pay attention because it's just too intense. So that day, I had been noticing something every morning when I woke up. I noticed how very often, and you're probably familiar with this experience, we wake up from being asleep, and maybe just coming out of a dream, and then we wake up and we're alert, and maybe we fall back asleep, kind of a fragment of a thought catches us for a moment, we might fall back asleep again, you know, into another dream for a minute or two or three, whatever, and then wake up again. And that might happen one or two or three times before we're fully awake. So I was noticing that moving from the dream state to the waking state to the dream state. It was interesting to watch in the morning. Then I was doing this walking meditation, and I began to notice a lot of background thoughts in my mind, not big demanding ones, just kind of whiffs of thoughts in the background as I was paying attention, you know, to the walking, to the movement. And then I began to notice both how frequent they were, these very light thoughts, you know, just passing through. And second, I began to notice how self-referential most of them were. You know, there was mostly about me, you know, thinking about the past, thinking about the future. And then I made the connection between the mind slipping into these background thoughts as I was walking, and the slipping into the dream state, you know, in the early morning. And I realized it was exactly the same process. You know, and so that even in my waking, more or less attentive life, there was this stream of falling into these dreamlike thoughts. And the phrase came to mind, it became a little mantra for my retreat. I'm dreaming myself into existence. And that's just what it felt like. Because all through the day we're having these thoughts arise in the background, they're not kind of the big, huge dramas, although sometimes they are, but mostly they're not. But we fall into them just like a dream. They're mostly about self. And they actually are creating the environment in which we're living. Yeah. And so to notice that, it was very illuminating. I repeated that phrase a lot through the days of my retreat, dreaming myself into existence, because it just seemed to cut through that process, or I became a little more aware of it more quickly, and it was very freeing. It was like each moment, it was a moment of waking up. So this is another way we can practice liberation through non-clinging. Really dedicating our mindfulness to the awareness of our thought process. Because, as I said, when we don't notice it, it has tremendous power. And by noticing them, there's a tremendous sense of ease and freedom. Buddha used some words in his description of this path of liberation, and they're very interesting words. And the words he used often just before he would talk about awakening. So it was a description of the mind just before it wakes up. And one of the words he used in this regard was disenchantment. It's a very interesting word in English. You know, when we hear the word disenchantment or disillusionment, what's our first reaction to those words? Oh, they're, you know, That person's disenchanted, or I'm disenchanted, I'm disillusioned. Mostly we think of it in a negative way. You know, oh, that's too bad. But think of what the word means. Disenchantment. Disillusionment. It's getting free of the spell of enchantment. It's getting free of our illusions. Being disillusioned couldn't be better. Because why would we want to live in illusion? Or why would we want to live enchanted? So we need to actually wake up from the enchantment of our lives. We need to wake up from the spell of our thoughts that are not noticed. You know, and this is really what leads to wakefulness. One of the greatest enchantments, and this is really for those of you who are, you know, experienced in practice, what I'm about to talk about now, this is not so much for people just beginning. One of the greatest enchantments is the enchantment we have with awareness itself. Right? Because even, you know, through practice, it doesn't take so long, you know, even when I say so long, after some years of practice, I think we do begin to get a sense of the impermanence and the flow of things, and we see, you know, sensations and thoughts and emotions come and go, and we begin to get a little bit of equanimity, you know, maybe a little sense of ease with it all. But in a very subtle way, and something that's very difficult to see, is our identification with the one who's knowing it all. You know, that we're the one who's seeing this. We're the one who's seeing things being impermanent. You know, we're the ones who are knowing. We create a sense of an observer or a witness. And at certain points in practice, you know, when the equanimity develops and things are going along pretty smoothly, the mind can get very bright, very clear. You know, there's a kind of luminosity to the mind where we're not struggling. Things are just rolling along in a very effortless way. We feel really as if we've arrived home. You know, this is what I've been practicing for. So I'd like to read something to you. It's very rare that you read first-hand personal descriptions of the enlightened masters and their moment of realization and what happened. There's a Thai meditation master. His name is Ajahn Mahabua, and he's still alive. He's reputed to be fully enlightened. Of course, one can never really tell from the outside. But he has this reputation, and he's written some extraordinary books describing his process of awakening. And there's just one thing I'd like to read to you, because it's so striking, and it's words that we almost never hear. And so I think they're important to hear. So he's saying that once he went to practice at this one temple, this one Wat in Thailand, and he said, "The problem of unawareness, ignorance, had me bewildered for quite some time. At that stage, the mind was so radiant that I came to marvel at its radiance. Everything of every sort which could make me marvel seemed to have gathered there in the mind, to the point where I began to marvel at myself. Why is it that my mind is so marvelous?" And there are stages, even before where Ajahn Mahabua is that way, it feels like that. It's just, you know, the mind is glowing and aware and alert, and all the factors of awakening seem present. "Looking at the body, I couldn't see it at all." Right? So there was no awareness of the body. There was just the mind, just awareness. "It was all space, empty. The mind was radiant in full force. The radiance is the ultimate counterfeit. And at that moment, it's the most conspicuous point. You hardly want to touch it at all because you love it and cherish it more than anything else. In the entire body, there is nothing more outstanding than this radiance, which is why you are amazed at it, love it, cherish it, dawdle over it, want nothing to touch it. But it's the enemy king, ignorance. That's quite a statement. But luckily, as soon as I began to marvel at myself to the point of exclaiming deludedly in the heart without being conscious of it, why has my mind come so far? At that moment, a statement of Dhamma spontaneously arose. This too I hadn't anticipated. It suddenly appeared as if someone was speaking in the heart, although there was no one there speaking. It simply appeared as a statement. If there is a point or a center of the knower anywhere, that is an agent of birth. That's what it said. But if there is a point or a center of the knower anywhere, that is an agent of birth. That's what it said. And it was in that moment that his mind was enlightened. And it's just a very direct pointing to this very, very subtle state of ignorance where our own minds can become so radiant, you know, and so luminous, and yet we become identified with that. There's a sense of being the one knowing that, or being that. And so real freedom is cutting through even that most subtle level of identification, of any sense of a knower at all. So again, as I said, this is not for people beginning their practice. You know, when we're mostly struggling with the pain in the knee and the restless mind. But I wanted to put out just, you know, as a way of holding the very big picture of what liberation is about. There's some wonderful lines from T.S. Eliot, the lines from the Four Quartets, where he says, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well. But that line, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. So that just captures, you know, the meaning of the Buddha, liberation through non-clinging to anything. Okay, the last thing I want to mention as a way of practice in our daily lives, it's another aspect of non-clinging, and this kind of brings it a little more down to our everyday reality. Has to do with the quality and the feeling of metta, of loving kindness. And we've talked a little bit about this on Sunday. Because what's the essence of metta? What's the essence of loving kindness? The essence of it is that we have let go of self-interest. And the interest of the other becomes paramount. I remember when I was doing intensive loving-kindness meditation, and at different periods in my meditative career, I would spend sometimes weeks, sometimes months at a time doing just metta or the Brahma-viharas. And I remember so clearly, you know, periods of practice all day long, just doing metta, spreading loving-kindness. And so often, I would see my mind, how am I doing? Am I feeling loving? How loving am I feeling? Oh, I'm getting really concentrated in this. Oh, good, this is going well. It had nothing to do with the other person. You know, it was all about me and how much metta I was feeling. But metta is not like that. That wasn't metta, that was just me. So I want to read something which I came across in New Yorker magazine. It was an article about the French essayist Montaigne, and it was the most beautiful description of metta, you know, and how it's expressed. It was so striking to me. So this is Montaigne talking about a friend, right, and his feelings towards this friend. He said, "In a truly loving relationship, which I have experienced, rather than drawing the one I love to me, I give myself to him. Not merely do I prefer to do him good rather than have him do good to me. I would even prefer that he do good to himself than to me. It is when he does good to himself that he does most good to me. If his absence is either pleasant or useful to him, then it delights me far more than his presence." That's a very remarkable expression. What metta is that? Care for the other person. You know, that wish for the other person to be happy. You know, I just, when I read especially that last line in terms of our more conventional way of understanding relationships, how often people would come to this conclusion, if his absence is either pleasant or useful to him, then it delights me far more than his presence. That's quite remarkable. And I just feel the tremendous quality of love in that, you know, of care for the other person. And if we could be that way with each other, it would be quite a remarkable world. So, do you have any comments or questions about the teachings, about your meditation? So the question is, in her doing of metta practice, she's always started by doing it for herself, and in the context of what I just said, does that seem like a wrong thing to do? No, I don't think it's wrong at all, because if we have unkind feelings to ourselves, it's not a very good foundation or a very strong foundation for extending that kindness and love to others. So it's like starting in the ground floor and stabilizing that, and then on the basis of that, you know, when we see what it's like to be kind to ourselves, then it's a simple transference of that feeling to others. So I think it's a useful thing to do. What's my description of emptiness? Okay, we have about 3 hours. That question could be expounded at length, but I'll try to just hit a few high points. One meaning of emptiness is that things do not have any intrinsic self-existence. So I'll give you an example. Okay. And I can't remember whether we talked about this on Sunday or not, but did we talk about the rainbow? Okay. The rainbow. So you go out, you know, after a rainstorm, you see a rainbow in the sky, and we see it. And most of us, when we see it, we feel quite happy. You know, it's a beautiful thing. When you look more carefully, is there anything in and of itself which is a rainbow? No. A rainbow is an appearance that arises when certain conditions come together. There's moisture, there's light, there's air. You know, when these conditions come together and there's an appearance of a rainbow. But the rainbow is not something in and of itself. It's an appearance arising out of conditions. So to say that something is empty means it's rainbow-like. That everything is arising out of conditions. Everything is an appearance arising when the conditions are there, necessary for it to appear. That's what it means to say empty of any essential existence in and of itself. But we have to remember that we are, in fact, seeing the rainbow. So even though we understand it's empty of inherent existence, the appearance of it is part of our experience. And this is the union, in Buddhist terms, of the relative and ultimate level. On the relative level, the rainbow is there, we see it, we enjoy it. On the ultimate level, the rainbow doesn't exist. You know, here's the glass of water. On a relative level, see the glass, understand its function, it holds water, and drink from it. Put it under a high-power microscope, there'd be no glass. You know, if you get to, I don't know, subatomic particles, you certainly don't see glass. But it's not that the ultimate level is here and the relative level is here. It's a union. The relative and ultimate level is one, and it just depends which level you're looking at. You know, you can look at it at the level of glass or rainbow. You can look at it at the level of subatomic particles or air, moisture, and light. The value of understanding emptiness in this way, of understanding the ultimate level, is not to disengage from the relative level. And people often misunderstand this in meditation or Buddhist practice. They think, oh, we need to reside in the ultimate level of emptiness, and it's all empty, and no. First of all, because we can't. You know, we are living on the relative level, and we're engaged in that way. But the understanding of the more ultimate level allows us to engage in the conventional relative level of our lives without so much attachment, because we understand the deeper level. Do you try to grasp at a rainbow? No. That's why? Because you know that it doesn't really exist. But it doesn't mean that you don't see it. You know, so that's just one further little PS to this. Self is like rainbow. Joseph is like rainbow. Right? So the whole Buddhist notion of selflessness is just what I've been talking about. It's understanding that what we call self, what we call Joseph, and each one of us, on the relative level exists, and we relate to it, and there's a whole dynamic of relationships. And on a more ultimate level, we see that self or Joseph is just an appearance arising out of the mind-body conditions coming together. So this is the understanding of selflessness in the Buddhist context. So that's... So how to describe what you've been reading as mind objects? Mind objects is simply a general term for whatever appears in the mind, like a thought, like an image, like an emotion. So it's very simple. It's not so much a technical term. It's just whatever we experience through the mind is a mind object.
Being and thought and
Okay, so are you speaking now about the four foundations of mindfulness, and is that the reference point?
Yes.
In which you're speaking about mind objects?
Yes.
Okay. So sometimes that fourth foundation is translated as mind objects. Is that what you're... Yeah. I think it's not the best translation, precisely because of this confusion. Well, feelings are also experienced in the mind. You know, and the third foundation is mindfulness of the mind. That's why the Pali, of course, is Dhamma Nupassana, or mindfulness of Dhammas. Right? The problem is that in English, the term Dhamma or Dharma, it can mean so many different things that it's such a broad term. The translation that has made the most sense to me for that fourth foundation of mindfulness is categories of experience. Because in that fourth foundation, it categorizes different experiences as being hindrances, as being factors of enlightenment, as being the Four Noble Truths, as being the Eightfold Path, you know. And so it's taking objects from the other three foundations, but it's putting them in categories. And so categories of experience, I think, is, for me, is the clearer translation of that term. It's how things function rather than the thing in itself. So does that refer to kind of just our cultural understanding of things? And the Buddha was pretty specific in that particular discourse, and in that fourth foundation, it's a very specific listing of categories. And so I would say in the context of that discourse, he's referring specifically to those particular categories that he lists. Of course, they're pretty comprehensive. You know, if you think of kind of the hindrances and the factors of enlightenment and the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Six Sense Bases, and what else is in there? You know, there's a lot that's included in that. So in talking about the luminosity of mind, and particularly the reading from the Thai monk, is it saying that that's the same as ignorance? It's the identification with it, or the taking of it, either to be self, or the attachment to it, because it's so wonderful. All of that is the ignorance. And it's very seductive. You know, it's an incredibly seductive state because it feels like, yes, this is what I've been practicing for, and we forget that it's liberation through non-clinging. It's not liberation through radiance. You know? It's pretty amazing how often we need to hear this. Because, you know, even when we've been practicing years and years and years, we can still be practicing for an experience and forget that what we're really practicing is not clinging. But that's what the essence is. Some little signal that you might look for in your practice, which I've seen come up a lot in my own mind, I call it the in order to mind. When I'm with an experience in order for something to happen, I'm with the breath in order for the next breath to come, or I'm with the breath in order to become calm, or in order to become peaceful, or I'm with an emotion in order to release it, or just as an example of how tricky this can be. This was from my time practicing in Burma with Sayadaw Upandita. I'd been there for quite some time, and my mind and body was pretty open and fluid, and there was a lot of luminosity, you know, and it felt really great. And there was this one like that in my neck. You know, so everything was, you know, great, but there was this. So I went to Sayadaw, and I was describing my experience, and I said, you know, it's just like this empty flow of light, but there's this one block. And I thought that I was giving him an objective description of my experience. He got on my case for calling it a block. And in that, when he reflected back, I realized just in that word, there is already desire and aversion. You know, when we hear the word block, block, not good, open. And he pointed out that what I was experiencing was tightness. That was the actual experience. Block was interpretation. And an interpretation that carried a lot of implication. So it's not about unblocking blocks. It's about not clinging, not identifying with whatever is presenting itself. There's hardness, fine. There's tightness, fine. Right? There's some emotion, fine. Can we be there? But rather than be lost in it and swallowed up by it and drowning in it, can we be mindful? Oh, the mind is like this now. The body is like this. So it gets very subtle how we overlay our concepts, even when we don't think we're doing it. So the question was, well, what do we do with concepts, which are a pretty big part of our lives? It's obvious that it's not that we let go of concepts or try to get rid of concepts. It's all of our communication, our way of understanding the world happens, you know, through the concepts. It's a question of whether we're seeing it, the concept as a concept, or we're taking it to be the experience and reality itself. So in other words, if I understood block as being a concept, right, then I wouldn't have been so caught in it, thinking I had to do something about it, and I would have been better able to see the actual experience of this tightness. When you hear a sound, and this again goes back to the synthesizing of the relative and ultimate levels. So, for example, you hear a sound. This is a great example. I'm not sure of what, but it's an example of something related to this. We'll see if you can figure it out. What's your first reaction when the smoke alarm goes off in your house? What's the first thing you want to do? Turn it off. Do we ever check to see if there's a fire? I never do. It's just shut the thing off. To the point of, you know, unscrew it. So this has something to do with concepts and understanding what concepts are, when they're useful, when they're not. This is kind of a train of association here. A yogi on one retreat was telling me this story. They just built a house in the woods. And they moved in. And as they were building, they had seen these great blue herons flying around. You know, it's beautiful. Yeah. And then when they moved in, they heard this chirping sound in their basement. And they were so happy, you know, because they thought that, oh, there must be a nest of these birds, you know. And every time they heard the sound, it just brought them joy, you know, because they'd seen the birds. And then, I don't know, some weeks later or whatever, some repairman came and went down into the basement, and he said, oh, you know, your smoke alarm down there is broken. Then every time they heard the sound, they were irritated. Same sound, different concept. So if we're confusing the concept for the experience, then we get locked into whatever particular conditioning we have around that concept. But it's not to say that concepts aren't useful, because they are, and we use it to describe the world. It's just we want to recognize that's what they are, and then to see, is this useful or is it not useful? You know, am I getting caught and imprisoned by it, or is it pointing to something that's freeing? Yeah. So this is an important point, because often people think, oh, you know, meditation, no concepts. Well, we couldn't live like that. But we don't want to confuse the concept for what it's pointing to. Did you hear that? Well, in the back they couldn't. So the comment was, the preface to the comment was, you know, when somebody tells a joke, you either get it and laugh or you don't. And he's kind of making the analogy, was the Buddha actually suggesting this long process of becoming aware of ourself? So is the implication there that this self-awareness is either immediate, we either get it or we don't get it?
Well, when you were talking about Montaigne, I don't think he was a meditator. He came to that through some other process. I don't think he meditated for 10 years and comes to that understanding that he
Right. Yeah, well, I think that's a good question, because, and it points just to the previous discussion of what you or anybody imbues in the concept meditation. You know, because if you think meditation means sitting in a certain position, you know, with your eyes closed, or, you know, whatever your concept is, that's going to be a very limiting concept. As Ajahn Chah so famously said, chickens sit on their eggs for days on end. It doesn't make them any wiser. So it's not about this. But it's interesting, because I think we all have lots of concepts about what we think meditation is. But if you begin to understand meditation as being awareness, rather than unawareness, it's being mindful rather than unmindful, then I could well imagine that Montaigne was very meditative in his life. He observed a lot. He was aware of a lot. There's another beautiful example of this, and I mentioned it to a few of you before. I was reading this in a biography of Henry David Thoreau. I was describing his death. He died at age 44 of TB. So very painful. The description of people who were with him at the time of his death, describing him. It's remarkable. This book is in a book by somebody called Harding. I forget the initials, but it would be worth looking at. So Thoreau was dying painfully. He was described as being as cheerful as ever, saying that there was as much comfort in perfect disease as in perfect health, because the mind always conforms to the condition of the body. That's remarkable. And just that, first the understanding of the mind, that the mind has the capacity, I mean, he used the word conform to, you could say hold, be aware of, that the mind always conforms or holds or can be aware of the condition of the body. And for him, there was as much comfort in perfect disease as in perfect health. He said death couldn't begin to trouble him. And then he had there's a nice little P.S. to all this. It said that in this biography, it said his Aunt Louisa asked him if he had made his peace with God. And he said, "I didn't know we had ever quarreled, Aunt." So again, I don't think Thoreau was a Buddhist meditator. But he was clearly remarkably aware and insightful. And so it's really to see the Buddha's teachings as a very powerful methodology for this. Other people may come to it in different ways, and these happen to be some remarkable people. And I don't know how common it is to reach that level of understanding. And that's why, for myself, I just feel this enormous gratitude to the Buddha's teachings that for someone like me and perhaps like us who don't have that amazing wisdom that Thoreau somehow developed, that there's actually a way to do it. And so that's really what it's about. It's about, are we aware or are we asleep? What is our collective, as a culture, our collective blind spot, or what we might pay attention to? I think it was best expressed by St. Augustine. You know, he had this famous prayer, "Dear Lord, make me chaste, but not yet." And I think it's the "but not yet" that we really have to look at, because I mean, in one way, we could say, you know, we are so blessed and so privileged. It's like everything that there is to be enjoyed, for the most part, we enjoy. You know, we most of us, I think, lead just amazingly incredible lives in terms of what's available and the way we live. And it's very seductive. The Buddha called it, he has a great phrase, and it's very powerful. You know, it's He said sights and sounds and smells and tastes and tactile sensations and thoughts, this is the terrible bait of the world. You know, this is what ensnares us. And then he goes on, and I don't remember the words of the following verse, but it's basically for those who have freed themselves from grasping, you know, their mind is freed and shine like the sun or something like that. Yeah, and that image has always stuck with me, kind of the terrible bait of the world and how we keep biting on it, thinking that it will give us some lasting peace or satisfaction. And what's so striking to me is that I think that for all of us, when we look back at our experience, at all the many, many happy, wonderful moments we've had in our lives, you know, we've had a lot of them. Where are they now? You know, when we look back, it's so easy to see the ephemeral nature of experience. So this is not a mystery to us. When we look back, we can see it so clearly in our own lives. But somehow, when we look ahead, we're under the spell of enchantment again. And how many of us are living our lives waiting for the next hit of experience, the next vacation, the next relationship, the next project, the next this, the next this. Even though when we look back, we see just how empty of substance, you know, of lasting substance, it all was. So we haven't made the connection. It's like there's this split in us between what we know in ourselves. Again, this isn't a question of belief. It's just really look at your lives, look at your experience, and see the difference between how you view things in looking back and how we engage in the world looking ahead. And it's quite striking, the difference. And then to see if there's a middle way, right, of being present, of being fully present for what's arising, but without that grasping, without that clinging, because that's the place of peace. Yeah. So how, in knowing the ephemeral nature of it all, how can you not be hopeless in that space? When I first went to India to practice, I was with my first teacher, Munindraji, and was in Bodh Gaya, which was the place of the Buddha's enlightenment, and at that time it was very undeveloped, and you know, sometimes we would walk through the villages around the main temple. And he said something to me which at the time I just thought was the hokiest thing in the world. You know, I just thought, what is he talking about? And so he'd be walking around and he'd say, oh, Joseph, I'm friends with the flowers. I'm friends with the clouds. You know, he would go on and on. Oh, I'm friends with this and I'm friends with that. And I just thought, you know, I was 21 years old, 22, I don't know. It just didn't make any sense to me at all. You know, it just sounded like sentimental something or other. Over the years of practice, I have so come to appreciate what he meant. And this involves another whole big topic, which is the topic of intimacy. You know, and so many people are in search of intimacy as the antidote to that hopelessness you're talking about. The big problem, I think, is that we're looking for it in the wrong place, that we don't really understand what intimacy means. Because I think mostly we're looking for it in another. If another would be a certain way for us or with us, that would fulfill our sense of intimacy. Of course, we can't control how other people are, and so it's always a little tenuous, you know, and often disappointing. But have you had the experience in meditation, when you're just sitting and the mind is quiet, and there's just the feeling of the breath or a sensation or a sound, and there's no separation at all. There's just, you could say, the purity or the oneness or the intimacy of that moment's experience, because there's no separation. You know, and I think those of you who have been practicing, at least at times, have probably had that experience. You know how fulfilling and satisfying that is. It's exactly the opposite of hopelessness, because it's completely full. It's complete. And there's no separation. There's not an I separate from. And that, it's in that experience that I began to understand Munindra's words. And he used the word friendship, but you could say friendship or intimacy or relatedness to everything that's going on. You know, whether it's the clouds or the... And again, a lot of it has to do with freeing ourselves from concepts, attachment to concepts. I was teaching in Russia some years ago in St. Petersburg. And maybe some of you have been there. You could tell it was a once beautiful city, but it's kind of dilapidated. But there's a lot of beauty in the city. So I was walking with this Russian friend down the street, and we passed an empty lot, and it was just filled with rubbish and garbage, and, you know, it's just an empty lot like that. And it was dusk, and we were walking by, and just my mind was in this non-conceptual space, and we're walking by, and I said to him, "Boy, that's beautiful." Because what my mind was seeing, I was just seeing color and form. I wasn't seeing garbage, I wasn't seeing rubbish, I was just seeing color. It was like an abstract painting to me. You know, I said, "Boy, that's really beautiful." And he looked at me like, "What are you talking about?" Because it's that quality of mind, that quality of, again, whatever you like to call it, intimacy or relatedness, that's always available. It's not dependent on another person being a certain way. It's not dependent on conditions. And that's the beauty of the practice, when we open to that space. That's always there. You know, it's not something we need to create. We just have to open into it. Just to just demonstrate how simple it is. This is not complicated. And you don't have to spend 20 years meditating to find this space. Just when you hear this sound, just listen. Let the sound be known. Try again. Hear so much in it. There's so many nuances and vibrations, and there's a whole world in that sound. You know, there's a whole world in everything. But mostly, we're not paying attention, and we are lost in our thoughts, and we are dreaming ourselves into existence. You know, so we're just not awake to it.
And these belief systems and blocks for the wedding, then it's not a matter of like thinking, oh, this is not real, future. The concept's not the bringing me, I think it's the inner work using either meditation or somehow find out what is it in me that's clinging to money or relationship. What is it that, what is the fear? Find that, work on that, and then clear it through whatever spiritual means. Then that just goes away. And then you will automatically become those, you know, non-clinging. It's not like you think you're waiting for it, but you kind of experience it. Is that like how it works?
It's an interesting question. And so the comment was, isn't the process of non-clinging more about working on and clearing away the deeper patterns in us, the emotional, psychological patterns, whether fear or insecurity, whatever they may be, that cause us to cling? And as we work and clear that out, the clinging falls away naturally. And the question, and it's not through thinking ourselves into not clinging that it's going to work. Okay, so that's a really good question. And I'd like to approach it from two sides. That often is the process of what happens in meditation. You know, we become more aware of these patterns, and we see them, we understand them, and through that awareness, the patterns themselves weaken, and so the behaviors that they condition begin to fall away. So I think that is an accurate description in part of the process, and I think many of us have experienced that. I would just be careful about limiting your understanding of how the mind can be freed to that process. Even though it often happens like that, there are other ways, complementary or different ways that it can also happen. First, to clarify, I think it's very unlikely that somebody can think their way to not clinging. I tried. On one retreat, I was just reflecting on the Four Noble Truths, you know, and where the Buddha said, desire is the source of suffering, craving is the source of suffering. So I remember I was just standing, I have a vivid memory of this. I was just standing there and I said, Joseph, craving is the source of suffering. Stop craving. It just seemed so simple to me. You know, why wouldn't one stop craving? So it lasted about 7.5 seconds until the next craving came. So it became clear that it's not going to happen by thinking it. However, I wouldn't confuse thinking about it with the factor of investigation. It's investigation in the Buddhist sense is not thinking about something. It's a direct looking at what's happening in the mind in that moment. That has tremendous freeing power. So it is very possible through investigation of a situation of clinging and desire where you really, or any kind of afflictive emotion, where it may not be necessary to go through the whole process of understanding its underlying causes, because we're seeing the moment so clearly. So I'll just give you one. There are hundreds of examples of this, but one that, for many years when I came back from India and started teaching, I was living at and in IMS, in the meditation center, in a room. And I would often have to move rooms when, you know, the room I was in, it was needed. And it was fine. You know, for many years, it was fine. I did this for about 13 years. But when I hit 40, I need some space. I had been living like in this community living for all those years, and I just need some. But you know, I didn't have any money, and sort of, how am I going to get a house? No, it just seemed impossible. Well, the Dharma, I mean, it's just so miraculous. So I talked to somebody about this. I just sent out a letter to a few people, myself and my colleague Sharon Salzberg, you know, to a few people we knew, and said, you know, this is our hope, our aspiration. Do you have any ideas? One person came forward, you know, who had the means, and basically offered us to build us a house. I mean, it was like a miracle. And so then I got really obsessively involved in the design. I mean, this was like my dream, you know. I was like, so it was really obsessive, as Rodney and others can attest to. So then finally, after, you know, it was a couple of year process of design and building, and it's a very nice house. So I moved in, and the first thing I did was to do a self-retreat. And the emotion that was coming up, more than any, was, well, first I was just feeling uneasy. You know, I didn't know what I was feeling at first. But with some investigation, I realized I was embarrassed. Because I had this concept, oh, Dharma teacher shouldn't live in a nice house. You know, and there I was in this really nice house, and so I was embarrassed by it, and I thought, I'll move out, I'll give it to the staff, I'll just live in a hut in the woods. Yeah, and I was kind of tormenting myself with this. It sounds funny now in retrospect, but what, you know, I was suffering over this. At a certain point, and this goes to the point of investigation as opposed to working through all the underlying issues. At a certain point when I realized, oh yeah, this is the feeling of embarrassment, then I realized it is so much easier to be accepting the feeling of embarrassment than to move out of the house. And that resolved the issue. And the embarrassment didn't last that long. So there are many levels of this. So I think we're getting... I have two...
Are you still living in the same house?
I am. And still enjoying it without the embarrassment. I think we need to end.